Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
Like I said, today we have two short ones that'll make into one medium-sized one. First thing to talk about is transformations. Sometimes you look at your data, and I would encourage any of you, whenever you collect any data, and it might be for your honors thesis, if you end up doing that, it might be for any reason you're collecting data, is do the EDA, the exploratory data analysis, and you see something that looks like a difference. It seems pretty clear there's a difference. We talked about this in the lab class the other day. And you do the ANOVA, and you get no result. You get a non-significant F. Okay? And that's something that, you know, usually should bother you. Because, and I've said this before, as my PhD supervisor says, statistics are there to prove what you already know. So you look at your means, you look at some graphs, whatever, you see a difference, but it comes up being not significant. So we end up with nothing. Now, it may be a violation of an assumption, and it may be a violation, in fact, it very often is a violation of an assumption. It may also be there's no difference, right? It may be the case that, you know, we could drop a quick graph here. It may be that you've got two groups, just make it a simple one. Okay, there's your two groups, but there's so much error that they actually don't differ. Okay? It certainly may be the case that, like in that case, because if these are standard deviations, the error bars here, these two overlap. This could be as high as this, this could be as low as this. In other words, there probably isn't a difference there. And that doesn't look like, note that the standard deviations and therefore the variances are roughly the same size. We haven't violated homogeneity variance. Everything's fine. So that may be the case that you look at that. And with EDA, you should say, actually, there's no difference there. That's why you always need error bars on graphs. And this is one of those things. Again, I was talking about in 3296 the other day in the lab class. I was saying that when people do their honors thesis talks every year, you guys only see the final versions. You don't see the practice versions where the five of us in the department act like the judges looking at people auditioning for American Idol. And you tell them what's wrong. You tell them what's right, too. But usually when they start, it's mostly wrong because they've done a lot of this stuff before. And one of the things I always say is, where are the error bars on your graphs? They show me a graph and I don't see error bars. And it's like, where are the error bars? There's no error bars. I can't tell. Means don't tell me enough information. They tell me part of the story. I need to know that. Right? Think about this. If we did a political poll in the class, well, and we ended up with, I don't know, who would you vote for? And it would be like half conservative and half, the first one in two parties. So half, say half conservative, half NDP. Let's just say that. So then we come out, we release a big news release. Latest poll shows conservatives and NDP neck and neck. There's 20 people in here. The margin of error is freaking huge. It's huge in that case. So in fact, it means, even if you were a representative sample of Canadian voters, which you're not, but even if you were, it tells us nothing. So numbers, means themselves only tell you part of the story. The whole story is told by means and some sort of error, variance, standard deviation, whatever. So it may be the case that, in fact, nothing happened. This actually does tell you nothing happened, okay? That tells you that. But it may also be the case that you've just violated some assumption, usually the variance assumption, the homogeneity variance assumption, and usually that's fixable. Okay? So if the variances are way too different, in other words, if one of these is really tiny and one of them is big, so if we had something like, let's just change this. So now, something weird's going on there. That they would still come out not different, right? You see these two standard deviations, they overlap. They would still seem to not be different. a binary Nova like them. But what's going on here? So perhaps we violated that assumption. Oh, that was cool. A different transition today. What can be done? Well, we can transform our data. Okay. And it's done through some sort of mathematical operation. All we are doing is changing the measurement units. Okay. So sometimes you'll hear people say that it's not fair. It's like you're cheating. It's like you're making up new numbers. People that don't know anything say that. They'll say, well, it's not right. You shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't be manipulating numbers after you've collected the data. The numbers don't know where they come from. As I always say, quoting my old stats prof, he also say, take touch of the data enough and it will tell you anything you want. But there are ways to properly torture your data. Okay? To make sure it's actually measuring the same thing using a different unit. Okay? So it is so. That's my reply to you. Of course it's fair. You just got to do it properly. You can't just say, well, what I'll do is I'll just add 15 to all these and nothing to these and it's fixed. No, that would be cheating. That would be making up data. However, if I took a number and I did this, so I had a number, we'll say it was X, and I want to make up a new variable called, and we'll call it X prime. Okay? And it's going to equal X times 9/5, and we're going to add 32 to all the numbers. What does that do? Well, it's going to change the variance, because multiplied by something. It's going to change the means. Right? Can anybody recognize that transformation? I just converted something from one thing to another.
I only did that at the beginning of the course. When you asked us to change, add 8 to.
We did stuff like that, yeah, and this is one of the reasons I talked about it. Do you recognize what I've done there, though? I've turned degrees Celsius into degrees Fahrenheit. They both measure temperature just fine, thank you. Right? And there's a quick and dirty one that we used, we learned when we switched over from Fahrenheit to Celsius, from metric, from imperial to metric in 1974. Which is double it and add 30. And that's close to that. So if you ever are curious about what the temperature is, and when you hear, the temperature, you're in the States somewhere, you divide by 2 and subtract 30. Right? Or just pull out your phone and change the thing from Fahrenheit to Celsius, and it'll just do it. So really, at first, this looks like something that's just sort of, the hell's that from? But they're both measurements of temperature, degrees Fahrenheit, degrees Celsius. They both have their advantages and disadvantages. Typically, people say that Celsius is more intuitive because water freezes at 0 and boils at 100. It doesn't matter. The other one worked perfectly well until we changed. I understand why we changed. I'm all for it, but I'm just saying that they taught me imperial to grade 4, then when they switched us to metric. So I just know a mishmash of different things. You guys changed, if you remember, in the first assignment, centimeters to inches. That doesn't involve adding a constant. That was just divided by 2.54. Right? It's like with pounds and kilograms. Right? Same sort of thing. If you have American recipes and it says that how many kilograms you have, or sorry, how many pounds something is, and you want to say how long do you put it in the oven for, and you're not, somebody who cooks a lot, so you go by those things rather than how things look and how they sound and how they feel. You eat something, and maybe it's raw, but after a while, you can touch meat and know the temperature it's cooked to and things like that, and it takes a little bit of skill. But you go, oh, that's pounds. Then you get a recipe from the UK, and it's all the temperatures are always in Celsius. Right, for the oven temperatures. Or my favorite ones in the UK where they tell you to turn your oven up to 9. These are older recipes because they had a dial that went from 1 to 10 and everyone had basically the same oven. Yeah, it's a different time. turn your oven up to gas mark 4. So really, that's all you're doing. You're turning one thing into another. So you're just changing the units. You're just simply changing units. We went from here from Fahrenheit to Celsius, or some sort of Celsius to Fahrenheit. I think we should use Kelvins. Zero would be no temperature, absolute zero. Today, it would be 270 out. Get in.
So what if you're not changing really the units? What do you do then? Like, you can't change units because it's not a standard measure.
It doesn't have to be a standard measure of the units. It doesn't have to be something that people know about. As long as you're doing something mathematically to it, you're doing, you're being fair, you're doing it to all the data, it's still, there's nothing
wrong
with
that. So then that would just be considered just adding a constant?
No, it wouldn't be adding a constant. You could be doing all kinds of different mathematical things. And we'll take a look at this today. There's all kinds of different things you could do. All right. For example, you could take the logarithm of something. So, taking the logarithm of a number makes really big numbers much smaller. It makes them smaller, and it takes small numbers and makes them smaller, but not as much smaller. Does everyone know what a logarithm is? If you don't, I can explain it. Put your hand if you don't know what it is. It's easy for me to explain. Okay, good. I'll feel embarrassed, because apparently they don't teach you anything in high school anymore. So, let's do log 10. It's the simple one. Okay, it's easier to understand. Oops. Let's go one. Okay. So, for example, this is a 10 log to the base 10. Log of 1,000 is 3, log of 10 is 1, log of 100 is 2, log of 1 is 0. Do you see the pattern? Well, in this case, yeah. I mean, that's where you look at it. What it really is the exponent. Right? Whoops, I didn't square that to the first. Let's square there. And 10 to the 0 equals 1. And you're saying 10 to the 0 equals 1? Yes, anything to the 0 equals 1. That's just a thing in math. So all we're doing is, look what happens though, a number like 1,000 becomes 3 and a number like 10 becomes 1. We're sucking down the really big numbers to be really small, and the small numbers, they get a little smaller, but not a lot smaller. Not a lot smaller. We use log scales all the time. Decibels are a log scale. 70 decibels is 10 times louder than 60 decibels. The Richter scale, you know, with the earthquakes. So the one in Japan a couple years ago, it was a 7.8 or something like that. We had, you remember, we had one here, like in Ontario, Quebec, that kind of, you could sort of half feel it depending on where you were in town. It was about a 5.8. It did nothing. And you think, wow, the one in Japan was only 2 more? Yeah, that's 100 times more powerful.
We had one.
Yeah, I remember that actually because I was in Toronto and I was in graduate school and I thought one of my roommates was coming in and it was just stuff shaking. It's like.
Oh, is it the water when you were standing on the street smoking?
Maybe it was that that caused it. You ever think of that?
I remember the ground shaking and we were like, wow, what was that? And then later in the day we found out it was an earthquake.
Hopefully we were smoking tobacco because it was something else you think, dude. It's just really good stuff, man. Yeah, I know. In fact, I was centered near Quebec City, and my mother-in-law actually went and did what you're supposed to do, which is go underneath your dining room table. And in fact, people did that on the news in Quebec City. They ran underneath, they live on TV, went underneath their news desk. Because that's where, it's a solid, safe thing if something falls. I ran into a door jam. But yeah, so something like that. And that was probably about a 5.8 or 5.9. The one that caused a nuclear accident and a tsunami in Japan, you think, well, it's only 2 more? Yeah, it's 100 times more powerful. Right? 100 times more powerful. 2. Right? And there's a lot of things in nature that are logarithmic. Anything that has a curve that looks like this is exponential. Well, the inverse of an exponent, as you can see here, is a logarithm. Reaction times are exponential. As you get more and more fatigued, your reaction times get longer and longer, and they get longer in an exponential fashion. The same thing happens with reaction times, say, on various drugs. So your reaction times get worse and worse the more alcohol you drink. They get longer and longer. Now think about this, though. If it's going up like this, the variance up here, when it's really high, is going to be way bigger than the variance way down here. So it's when we have a really huge variance, in fact, it's a lot like this, and a really small variance. Okay? We don't typically use log to the base 10, though. That's just for demonstration purposes. We typically use log to the base e, which is also known as the ln, or the natural logarithm. E is a constant in math. It's, you know how pi is a constant? It's like e is 1 as well.
So it's supposed to be a 1?
No, it's ln, logarithm, natural logarithm, ln. It's 2.71828 and then a whole bunch of others, mostly ones and eights. It's a constant in math. It's like pi. It's one of those things that shows up a lot. And it shows up a lot in natural phenomena, which is why this is called a natural logarithm. Now, negative values are a problem. The logarithm of a negative value is undefined. You can't take a logarithm of a negative number. You can't. Try it on your calculator. You'll get e. But not that nice e here. You get e for error. It's like dividing by zero. It can't be done. Well, fine. Add a constant. So do the logarithm of x plus k. So if the lowest value you have is 5, I don't know, add 6 to all of them. So the lowest value you get is 1, which is as now 0. Because you can't have a logarithm below 0. So you got like minus 5 is one of your scores? Well, just add 6 to every score, then take the logarithm. Then the lowest value you're going to get is going to be a 0. Because the lowest value you get now is 1, because you had minus 5, you added 6. Okay?
Can you do a logarithm on, like, a decimal?
Oh, yeah. Okay, with a calculator. That's a hard thing to do in your head. And you can get decimal values for logs, too, right? Like, the log of, like, of 99 is going to be 2.9 something. Yep. And your calculator will do it, or frankly, and I hope a lot of you guys went and played with SPSS yesterday, SPSS will do this for you. You have one column in SPSS, there's actually, I believe, a thing that says transform, and you choose what transformation and say put it in this column, and it just does it. But you have to make sure you don't have anything below zero. It can't do anything below zero. So this is used a lot. In fact, it's a matter of course. If you have reaction times, you always use log transformations. Okay. So that's logs. Square roots. I'm hoping you all know what square roots are. Square roots are used with counted data. How many of? So, if you're counting how many words were recalled, if you're counting how many visits there were to a feeder, right? Things like that. And it's also used when the means are proportional to the variances. What you do is you find out, you take the means and their variances and see if they're proportional. So, if the means go up by 2, the variances go up by 2. Which happens with counted data. It's just a phenomenon. Take the square root of the original value, number, or add a constant first. Again, if you don't want to do square roots of negative numbers, so add a constant first if you've got some negative numbers. No problem. Easy peasy. So it's pretty straightforward. It's not something to be too concerned about. You will see people do this a lot with counted data in papers if you're. If they're looking at number of errors, number of visits to something, yeah, man.
I was
going to
ask counted data, but you just said it.
Yeah, just counting number of stuff, whatever the things are, if that's what your data are, rather than something else. What about the reciprocal? That's when you just take a fraction and make it turn it upside down. Two-thirds becomes three-halves. That's what reciprocal is. So all you're doing here is you're taking the reciprocal. This makes the range smaller. That's one of the sort of side effects of this. So the variances get smaller. So a lot of times you would use something like this. When you see a difference, this would be like if we saw, remember we had up here the big error bar. It may be the case if we took the reciprocals, the variances get smaller enough that maybe it actually is significant. Right? This is great with latencies. So elapsed time. Except for reaction time, where you use a lot. So if you're a classic example of this is maze running in rats, and you're looking at the amount of time that takes them to finish running a maze. And in fact, when rats have learned that there is nothing at the end of an arm of a maze, they will run much more slowly than if they've learned that there's something at the end of the arm of some food. And it's pretty reliable. You watch it happen, and then you do the stats just on the latencies, and you almost always, very often, get no significant difference. In fact, when this was first done, this is what happened, and in fact, my stats prof, Ian, told the person who was doing the work, "Well, I see a problem. You should just take the reciprocal of it." All you have to do is take the reciprocal. All you're doing is converting latencies into speed lag. That's all you're doing, right? Think about it. Time, 1 over time, like meters per second, miles per hour, kilometers per hour. So all you're doing, and this is a case where this might look funny, though we do have a lot of logarithmic units. Square roots might seem kind of odd. But turning latency into speed is intuitive. And that's really all you're doing. You're just flipping them over. So it's used a lot with latencies. How long did it take to complete the task? How long does it take for the animal to run to the end of the arm? As long as it's not reaction time, because that will be logarithmically distributed. So really all you're doing here is turning time into speed. Okay? Questions so far? So they'll basically give you your sort of cookbook. When this happens, do that. Oh, here's a fun one. The arc sine. You never said there'd be no trigonometry, did you, Dave? Okay. You don't have to know what an arc sine is. This is used with proportions a lot. So if you've got percentage correct or proportion correct, right? If you've got, and I guess usually what it is, usually proportion correct. Okay. What it does is it stretches out both of the tails of the distribution and leaves the middle ones intact. Now think about this for proportions. If it's, because proportions are like, what the most likely thing by chance to get with a proportion is going to be 0.5, right? Just by chance. Because it's yes or no proportions. You're going to get a lot more scores right there, and you're going to get a lot fewer scores where everything's wrong and where everything's right. So if I was to give you all a test, a true-false test on something that you know very little about, how about quantum physics? Just pick something. I wouldn't do very well either. Most likely, we're going to get what?
0.5.
Because we're going to be right half the time, wrong half the time. Some of us are going to get them all wrong. That's going to be pretty rare. Just by chance. Even if it was written in Russian, you're going to get half of them right. And some of us are going to get them all right just by dumb luck. We don't want that. Because what if they were two different groups, and one group was near the top, and one group had a bunch of the middle ones? Now the variances are going to be so much different. So what we want to do is do something that stretches the tails out, so it goes from a distribution that looks like this, one that looks more like this. Then we're going to get more uniform variances. Because if we have one group that's taken from here, and the other group's from this area here, this is going to have a much bigger variance than this group. There's more scores they can have. But what if we pull it all out like that? Now these two groups have the same variance. You look concerned. Does that make any sense to you? Okay, think about this. We've got... I've had you both read a passage about quantum physics, both groups, and it's written in English. Okay? You're now both going to do the true-false 10-item test on quantum physics. I'm going to give it to you guys in English. I'm going to give it to you guys written in Russian, and not phonetic Russian, in the Cyrillic alphabet. Backwards threes and funny-looking T's and O's with lines through them, and just letters you've never seen before, except if you watch, you know, illegal pirated feeds of the KHL. Like, there's no way you've even seen these letters. Right? You guys, at least you can read. So you read it and like, oh, yeah, it mentions something about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, that's there. There's a certain beauty in them being, you know, knowing yes or no in a quantum, there's a joke there that no one's getting. So, anyway, you guys are bound to get a few more right than these guys. These guys are going to be right around 0.5. Because they can't, unless some of you guys read Russian. No? Okay. Because if it's not, we'll just change the language. Write it in Thai. A traditional Turkish script. You know, just something nobody's ever seen. You guys are maybe going to do, most of you get around 0.5, but some of you will be over here. Like, where you guys are from is more over here. Your variance is going to be smaller than their variance. Their variance, most of their scores, they're going to be randomly distributed. Yours is not. Yours is going to be closer to the tail. What we want to do then, and that's going to have a smaller variance in one group than another, and we don't want that. And the smaller variance is happening at the tails, at the extremes. So what we want to do is do something that takes numbers that are distributed like that and pulls them out. And an arc sine does that.
So it makes it linear then?
Yeah, linear, but more linear. Not linear, more uniform. It makes things a little more uniform by pulling the tails in. Yeah, I was exaggerating there. Okay. Yeah, it's hyperbole.
Do we need to know how to do this?
No.
Okay, good.
You have to know how to write things down. Seriously, because I don't really know anymore how to take an arc sine. Well, I never did. You used your calculator. Or a table. You know, you can use arc sine tables. Those old trig tables we old people had to use in high school. Not even they teach trig anymore. They just say, you know, there's triangles, and they move on. Hey, look, triangles. Do those have four sides? Close enough. You get an A. I'm pretty sure that's what happens in high school. I'm convinced of that. So, let me be perfectly clear. I don't think any of you guys are stupid. I just think no one teaches anything anymore. And also, people get advised things like, oh, well, you hit grade 10, you don't have to take math anymore. That's up there with, well, when am I going to go to England? I don't have to take English.
That's funny, my daughter just came home for next year's course, and I was looking over their requisites for the whole high school year, and I was like, where's the math?
No, that's true.
And I said, you're taking math?
Good.
You don't have a choice.
No, and people should. And even if it's the general math, not the university stream, that's no problem. People should, you use math every day.
Well, she plans to go to post-secondary,
sure.
So I told her, you need to take the math. I said, and I would suggest taking something that looks similar to
Well, almost anything in any sort of social science or science takes stats. But I mean, math in general, we use it every day. And as the show Numbers has shown us, you can use it to solve crimes. I love that show. It was one where he did multiple regression. It was great. It's like, oh, look, the math's right. It's one of the few that I actually understand math. An arc sine, it's basically the opposite of a sine. S-I-N. But S-I-N-E, but S-I-N is the way you would write it out mathematically. So it's actually not really completely just the arcsine. You know, 2 times the arcsine square root. So you take the square root of the number, you take the arcsine of that number that you've taken the square root of, then you multiply times 2. That does the best job of pulling out the tails, that transformation. Now, it's interesting because I've had this case where one of my students a couple of years ago, more than a couple, 5 years ago, who's now a PhD student at Concordia in neuroscience, Shauna, she was looking at her data and she couldn't figure, we knew there was a difference and she couldn't find one. And I said, well, these are proportions. Just do the arcsine transformation. She said, I don't even know what that is. I said, you took 3256, you might DA for Christmas. I don't remember. Shut up, I hate you. That's me. I didn't drop any F-bombs in there. If I did that, that would totally be Shauna. Her thesis was actually on swearing. That's how much she swore. Thing is, we did the arcsine square root transformation, and suddenly a difference showed up that we knew was there, but it didn't show up in the data. It didn't show up in the analysis. So this is something you often do with proportions. Okay, when do you transform your data? And that's just this is just a sampler of possible transformations. But I think those are the most popular ones, like the most common ones. Well, you don't do it every opportunity you get. You don't just immediately take your data and automatically transform it. Even though it's easy to do with SPSS or SAS or SysStat or Statistica or Google Docs or Excel. I mean, it's trivial to do these transformations, but there's no reason to always do them. If the variances are messy, that's when you should start looking. And pick a transformation based on the sort of rough guidelines I've given you. Because I've pretty much covered every, like 95% of the variance problems that we have are fixed by the transformations I've talked about today.
Dave?
Yep.
What do you mean by variances are messy?
One's way bigger than another.
Okay.
Yeah, something like that. They just, when you violate the homogeneity of variance assumptions, what I'm talking about here. And violate the hell out of it, too. Not just like 1.7, 1.8. That I doubt a transformation is going to fix that. But if 1.7 and the other one's 49, that should tell you something. One variance is 7 times bigger than another, and the rough rule of thumb is one variance not is it 4 times bigger than another? If it's less than 4, you're probably fine. That's just a rough sort of rule of thumb you can use. If your data don't violate your the assumptions, don't transform your data. And if you already find the difference, don't transform your data. I remember I've had this discussion when I was doing my PhD, and I was using proportions, and Sarah said, don't you do an arcsine transformation? I said, why would I? And she said, everyone does. I said, well, I don't jump off bridges when everyone does. My mom told me not to do that. I said, look, we already found the difference. Why complicate it?
Your difference is not really significant.
That's when you do this.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you found a difference.
Yeah, but if it's not significant, you didn't find a difference, right? So, but if you find a difference that looks to you like it should be significant, then this is when this kind of stuff comes in more useful. You present the untransformed data in your paper. You mention in your results section that you transformed the data. But you don't do a graph of arcsine of 2 times the arcsine square root of the percent correct. I don't know what that means. I know what a really good score is in a proportion, 0.9, 0.8, 1. Those are great scores. Low scores are 0, 1, 0.1, 0.2. If it's 50-50 chance, 0.5 is most common. I don't know what 2 times the arcsine square root of 0.9 is. I just don't know. I could look it up. But when you're writing a results section, when you're reading a results section, you don't want to have to look things up. The idea is you can glance at it, and you guys have read papers, and I know some of you guys have read a results section for the lab class. When you read a paper or write it, the idea is to communicate to the reader what happened in the fewest number of words possible. Can I look at a graph and go, oh, I see. And then look and say, oh, yeah, significant. Done. Right? So you guys that are in the lab class might be wondering, why didn't we transform our latencies in the Stroopcast experiment? Because it was so clear that there was a difference. We didn't have to. Why didn't we transform the proportions or the counts, in fact, that we used in the priming experiment? Because we found no decay whatsoever with priming. So why transform it? It doesn't help anything. We'll still find nothing. Right? So you only do it when you violate an assumption and then you present the untransformed data. You mention your results section. I transform the data. Okay? This is something you might run into when you do your thesis. And this is why I want to mention it now. It's one of those things that sort of stands on its own. That's why I thought I would mention this thing. Questions about this stuff? Okay, that's our first installment today. Our second installment is about post-hoc comparisons. So, for clock transformations, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about post-hocs. I hate post-hoc comparisons. I'm going to get that out of the way. I hate them. Well, hate's strong. I question their utility. Let's go with that. Okay. So you got a significant F. Right? So you didn't know, maybe you've transformed your data, maybe you haven't, I don't know. But you got a significant F value. Now what? So your original hypothesis, your HO, was mu1 equals mu2 equals mu3 equals dot 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 equals mu is okay. And your alternative hypothesis is two of these are different. At least two of these are different. Which two? The alternative hypothesis doesn't tell you which two. It says that at least two of these are different from each other. Wow. Now, if it's a two-group experiment, it's pretty obvious, and you're done. Write it up. Get published. Get into graduate school. Get a master's degree, a PhD. Get a job. Get tenure, get promoted, get articles published in Nature, become famous, review articles for Nature, end up being asked onto the Daily Show to explain how awesome and funny your results are. My career's partway to that, but it's not, you know, that's just the trajectory I'm looking at. So the question you're asked is which two means differ from each other, or which three means differ from each other. Right? Okay. Well, there's a lot of ways to attack this. One of them, probably historically the first one was what was called the Bonferroni correction. And I don't know if you've had Bonferroni. It's really good, especially when they bake it. It's a joke. This is some guy named Bonferroni who came up with this little correction. Basically, it's a t-test. Now, if you did regular t-tests, the alpha would go up. Remember the last quiz? Why don't you do a whole bunch of t-tests? Because the alpha gets high. It's, in essence, what you're doing here. But if you do t-tests, you can't use alpha equals 0.05. Okay? The Bonferroni t-procedure takes care of this. What it's going to look at is the number of comparisons you want to make. It then divides the alpha level of 0.05 by the number of comparisons you make for what your critical alpha level now is. Now, this is something that, when you used to do these by hand, there had to be special tables, because you look, what are the critical t-values for when there's four comparisons, or two, or two is 0.05, so it's the same as the regular t-table. What if it's four, or three, or seven, or nine? And you look this up. So it's 1 over n, and n is the number of corrections you're doing, the number of comparisons, times alpha. So if you're doing If you're doing three comparisons, then it's 1/3 of 0.05. That's what your critical value becomes for a t-test. This is probably intuitively the easiest one to understand. So if we've got three groups, we've got to do three t-tests after we do the ANOVA. right? Because we've got to compare group 1 to group 2, group 2 to group 3, and group 1 to group 3. You also might look at that, though, and say, maybe your graph looks like, here, let's put an extra bar here. That. You might look at this and say, oh, I really only want to do 2. I don't want to do 3. These aren't different. And maybe they're both control groups. So this is a... this is just a regular, this is a rat study, this is a regular control, and this is a sham operation, and this is an operation of some sort. And a sham control, what you often do with these experiments, you would put the rat under, but you don't do any operation on it, so what you're doing is controlling for the effect of the anesthetic. Okay? So oftentimes you have more than one control group. You're not really interested if the sham control differs from the regular control. It doesn't matter. What matters is, does your experimental group where you did some operation, is it different from the control group? So in that case, maybe you're only doing one. Or maybe you're doing two. You say, I'm interested in both of these. Is this one here, the operating group, different from the sham group and different from the control group? But are these two groups different? I don't care. So now the number of comparisons you're doing, the number of corrections is 2. So it depends on the number you're actually interested in doing.
The value or the total of the two groups, the control and the sham, and divided by 2 to get the.
No, that's actually, but yeah, you can do things like that, but there's really. If you're to do something like that, I would just do compare this to the control. Here's what the formula looks like. All it is a t-test. It's called t-prime, that's why there's a little teardrop guy there, a little comma, a little apostrophe, I guess that is. So it's t prime, and it equals the first mean minus the second mean divided by 2 times the mean squared error over n, the square root of that. Well, you say, well, shouldn't it be divided by, it's a t-test. Well, that was good. That's my new personal best. So a normal t-test, wouldn't it be this, right? Wouldn't that be the normal denominator? Numerator, denominator. Yeah, denominator. Well, those are variance estimates. That's what that is. And we do it twice. Okay? We're using 2 times the mean squared error over n. N is the number of subjects per group.
Are you saying the basically the same?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So you would do the exact same calculation to figure that out?
Yeah. Yeah. So after you've done, you have the mean squared error. So just because you did it in NOPA, then you take the two groups you're interested in, take one minus the other, divide by the square root of 2 times mean squared error over n, and then you get a critical, you get an obtained t value. You look it up in a special t table called the Bonferroni t table, and it says how many corrections do you have for n to 0.05. You look, and if it exceeds it, you say the groups are different. So it's the only difference you're doing here is you already calculated this. And the t-table you use is a different kind of t-table. And, of course, you don't do these by hand typically anyway. Though what I almost always do these by hand. Because I don't know that what difference I'm going to find before I do an analysis. When I get the analysis that comes up, I look at it, right? And I know that you may run into this when we look at your thesis data. We look at it, and I'll say, oh, there's a difference there. Just a second, I can do a t-test. And I've got a calculator. And the mean squared error is looking at me, the output. Well, that takes some time to do it. Rather than run it again, but choose the thing that I want to do a Bonferroni T procedure between these two means. That's an interesting thing. Takes too long. Why not just take a pencil and a paper and a calculator? This takes, you have all the information. It involves doing a takeaway and a divided by. You know. Oh, and a square root. Now, there are other approaches. There are other approaches. The Bonferroni T I like just because it's intuitively pleasing. It makes the most sense. It's a standard t-test. You can also do something called the studentized range. This takes a look at, this gives you a value called Q. And this is the largest mean minus the smallest mean So now you're looking at the whole range. Divided by the square root of the mean squared error over n. Not 2 times the mean squared error this time, just the mean squared error. And you're looking at the largest mean minus your smallest mean. So largest minus smallest. Again, you would not, you could do this by hand. This is so much screwing around because now we have to look something up in a Q table. And not all stats books have studentized range Q tables. So this is one of those cases where what you do is you click the option. You maybe would run it again. What it tells you then is if the Q thing says it gives you a number and it says how far the means have to be different by to be significantly different. So it gives you a number like 3. So any 2 means that are different by 3 are then significantly different. Another one is the Newman-Cools, or also called the student Newman-Cools. These are all based on t-tests, so student gets credit here, which is, as you know, actually gossip. But this gives you a value called W. Again, I'm never going to ask you these things. I'm going to ask you what a Q is or a W is. It's useful. Because unless you teach stats, you don't know what these things are anyway. Honestly. People just say, do some post hocs.
So we don't really need to know how to do these for tests?
Well, no. Just like, on tests, I'm not going to have you do an analysis of variance by hand.
It's just for the knowledge of reading.
Yeah. Yes, it's teaching. It's what I do. It's just teaching. What you do here is you get that Q value, and then it gives you how big a range do you want? So how many means are you comparing? And then you look up 0.05, and then you get the degrees of freedom. So this is a value you look up, this, the Q, and then you multiply it times the square root of the mean squared error over n. And it gives you a number called W sub R. This tells you, again, it gives you the same kind of thing. It comes out with a range, and it says any means that are different by this much. The difference with the Newman-Cools is that with the studentized range, it does largest to smallest. This just does how many... If you only want to do like 3, if you have like 5 means and you only want to compare 3 of them, you can just do 3. It does a smaller number of comparisons, is what this does. This is probably the most common one. Okay? So it's any set of comparisons within a certain range. It does a subset. Okay? So all comparison with a range of 3. I don't know why I keep using the number 3, but that's what I'm talking about. So any comparisons of like 3. So in a range of 3. Instead of, say, all 7, you want to just look at 3 at a time. And you may want to do this because, again, you got something where I've got 6 control groups and 2 experimental groups. I'm really interested in a range, in that case, of 3, right? Because 2 experimental groups and a control group. That's all I care about. I don't care if the control group's different. And a lot of times in these physiological experiments especially, you might have 5 and 6 control groups. It really does happen. You'll have a control group, a sham-operated group, only anesthetized group. So a sham-operated group might be... So one group's only anesthetized, the sham group might be that it has its head open, and then it has its clothes back up, and so back on, or actually should include, and then it recovers. So that's 3 control groups right there. You're not interested in all those 3, you're interested in 1. And you get 2 control groups. You don't want to do all 5 or 2 control groups. You don't want to do all 5. Who cares? You want to do 3. This also works with something called Tukey's HSD. But Tukey's HSD is similar, but it always uses the largest possible range. So it's kind of like the studentized range. Tukey's HSD. HSD stands for honestly significantly different. It really, really does. What you do basically, except for the Bonferroni, which I guess, like I said, I would just do by hand if you want to do that, You just choose this as an option in SPSS. In fact, I believe it's called comparisons as an option. And you just click it, and it prints them all out. And usually you hope they all agree with each other. Which one should you use? Well, even there's ones I haven't talked about. There's ones you should never use. There's one called the Chaffee test. It's so conservative, that test, that even when you find significant Fs, it kind of finds no difference between groups. Conservative is great. I mean, conservative stats, and in science in general, it's a good thing. But if there's a difference there found by the Nelson variance, I kind of want a difference between a couple of groups to show up. Right? Maybe that's just me. There's also another test you'll see called the LSD, which is the least significant difference. So, frankly, what I'll be honest with you, what most people do is they do all of them because it's easy to do. It used to be you didn't do all of them because you did them all by hand and it took time. But now what people do is they just click, you do all. Do them all. I'd stick to one in a given paper. It makes you look a little disingenuous if you use one and then in the next experiment, I decided to change over this one. Because everyone knows you decided to change because that worked with your data, because it fit with your hypothesis. You shouldn't do that. I've usually used HSD, but I've done an Nelson variance. Just because it's probably the most common one. Everyone understands it. You know, but I've used SNK too, student equals. You don't see Chaffee tests hardly at all because they're so damn conservative. You don't see a lot of Bonferroni corrections, which is odd to me because it's intuitively the most pleasing of all of them. Questions about that? Now, you should also realize that sometimes you get data, okay? And you've got a couple of groups of, let's say you have two groups and they're all chickadees. So let's say you're me and it's 20 years ago. So you've got two groups of chickadees and you get a, it's a long, arduous task to explain this to you, and I won't, and it will bore the shit out of you, you can go read it. But what you come up with these percentage corrects. And everything else just works. You didn't transform anything. And you got one group had, let's say, 63%, and one group had 78%. Right? Percent correct. And now you want to say, are they better than chance? And it's 50-50, so you know. So, and then chance is 50. So in that case, you want to use t-tests. Right? Because all you're doing is comparing obtained means, 63 and 78, to some theoretical value. So you get this, you do that, x bar 1 minus mu over the square root of that divided, what that should be, 5 by 2. Well, we know mu is going to be 50, right? We know square root of n, well, I can tell you there are 4 birds per group. So you're going to do 4 for both of them, so divide by 2. That's why I put 2 there for a second. And then you wonder, what is the standard deviation? Do I have to recalculate this? And yeah, you could. You could go back to all 600 trials that you ran with your birds. Right? You can go back to an entire year's worth of data stored on floppy disks. You could. And get the standard deviation. You can certainly do that. Why not? But you know what else you have? You already did an analysis of variance. You have this. This is that. Mean square is variance. So when I did this, I just actually used my mean square error because it made complete sense. Right? This was one of the few times in my life that I ever had to explain something like PhD supervisor because she's smarter than me. But I'm better than her at statistics. And she said, well, why didn't you go back and grab all your data? I said, because I have a variance estimate right here. And in fact, it doesn't just even take into account these two conditions. It takes into account all these birds doing a whole bunch of other conditions, too. It's a better estimate. And she believed me because she knew I knew the stuff better than she did. That was one thing in the world. I know that and hockey statistics better than her. Everything else, she wins. So that's what I did, right? I just put this in here. Worked out fine. Just like you'd expect. I don't know if I mentioned in the paper actually how I did it, because what I did was perfectly statistically fine, so there was no reason to have a little note written of what I did. It wasn't something fancy, but it wasn't something people would normally do. But you have to realize, when you have mean squared error, it's variance. It's an overall variance estimate. And in fact, when you've only got one group, you might say, well, let's use a variance estimate that takes into account more observations. And you do, we use mean squared error because it takes into account all the birds and all the conditions. So it's a great way to go. Those of you that have taken Dwayne's 2126 may recognize a question kind of like that, except not using mean squared error from this final example. It's actually a question I wrote because it's on data that I collected. That's why eventually, in that course, you run out of things to make examples up with, and then you just start going, oh, just go back my own data, it's real. So something to remember, mean squared error is just an estimate of variance. And you can just interchange it. It's not a problem. Not a problem. All right, you guys have any questions or anything? You feel cheated out of your tuition because we're going to end 15 minutes early? All right, have a good break. Unless you have another class, then go to class.
You don't know, but there's something that I've got to say. I don't think I can hold on for another day. So many questions still running around in my brain. I'm so unsure.
This podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, Sharealike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me, because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.